Thank you very much, Ernie. Hey, everyone. It's 310 on WGN on a kind of cloudy start to your three-day weekend. Thank you so much for spending some of your time with us. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. The show is all about looking at today's news topics and things that affect you from a legal lens. I am not an attorney. If you didn't know that, you'll quickly figure that out. So I'm here to ask all the questions of the experts. And we'll be doing a lot of that today. But we start most shows with the crazy lawsuits, and in 2018, a New York couple took their 30-year-old son to court, hoping a judge would force him to do what? Let's get thanks for all the phone calls. They were lighting up the board. Sue in Waukegan, which, by the way, I'm so happy that we have a Sue on, considering that is also a legal term here on Let's Get Legal. Sue, thanks for calling today.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm great. It's nice out.
It
cloudy,
is.
But nice.
Yeah, it's cloudy, but the temperatures are a little bit down. So what did this 30-year-old son, what was he forced to do by a judge?
I'm thinking that his parents forced him to move out.
Yes. Mark and Christina Rotundo were their names, sent their son a series of eviction notices, even offering more than $1,000 to help him land on his feet in a new place. That failed. The parents went to court. What do you think the judge did, Sue?
Did they agree?
They did.
Yeah.
The judge kicked out the 30-year-old. Like, and I don't want to, like, poke fun. Like, look, living with your parents when you need a gig is an important thing. When I was 26, I moved back in with my parents, and that was a cool experience. They were wonderful, stayed there for a year, and then they started giving me subtle hints to find a new place. Sue, how about you?
30 is old enough.
Yeah, 30 is a little bit is up there, certainly. Sue, you win. I don't have a prize for you, but I will defend you in court one day if you ever need it, okay?
Well, thank you so much.
Yes, have a great day, okay?
Thanks, you too.
Thank you very much. Sue, our winner here today, aptly named as well. Thanks for all the other callers that we had on in. I think that one was kind of easy, Iridian. I think a lot of people remember that case from back in 2018. Don't worry, we've got a lot more opportunities for folks to call on in, 312-981-7200. We're going to have a lot of fun along the way. I've got more crazy lawsuits. Shocker that in the United States of America, I have a whole bundle, a whole well of crazy lawsuits to choose from when I go ahead and play this game. But we'll do more of those a little bit throughout the show, as well as at the end of the show. Oh, and by the way, Iridian, I should mention, we are 3 hours today. Normally, we wrap up at 5. We've got an extra hour here this afternoon, so we're going to use it well. We've got great guests lined up. And then at the end of the show as well, this happened a couple weeks ago. We played Name That Legal Movie, and we're going to do it again today. Last week was Name That... What did we do, Iridian? Do you remember? We played other clips. I don't know if it was songs. I keep on forgetting. I already forget last week by the time we get to this week.
It was definitely theme songs.
Theme song. Oh, yeah. Theme songs from law shows. Yeah. Yes. This is going to be quotes from law movies or movies that are law adjacent. And you're going to be able to guess in, and it'll be a lot of fun. Look forward to that in the 5 o'clock hour. But again, we got a lot of great stuff coming up. In just a little bit, we're going to chat with Dean Vic Amar from the University of Illinois. We're going to talk a little bit about the big abortion decision by the Supreme Court, or indecision, kind of a murky waters there on exactly what happened. I know a lot of people are confused about what it means and how the Supreme Court kind of operates outside of their normal schedule, right? We're kind of used to them hearing cases in the fall, then we find out in the spring what they rule. But with the pandemic and with emergency orders, Vic Amar, who clerked for the United States Supreme Court, Justice Blackmun, I believe, has all the inside information. But it's more than just that. We'll talk to him about the abortion case, but we're also going to ask him questions that you might have, dumb questions. 312-981-7200. Of course, there's no such thing as a dumb question, but I want to know, do the Supreme Court justices actually get along? Do they chat about the cases as they go? Are they friendly? Are they not friendly? Are there arguments that break out, right? Because it's a workplace like everywhere else, right? I know it's the esteemed court, but some of the most powerful people in our country, but like, they still have to like go to the same break room, right? Like, I'm sure they have one in the Supreme Court. They've got their own chambers and stuff, but I'm sure they have disagreements. So Vic Amar is going to talk about that. And then the entire 4 o'clock hour, it is Labor Day weekend. So we've got employment attorney Jeffrey Colwin in. He's going to take your calls too. We all have questions about what's happening at work, whether it's now with the COVID vaccines, with the mask requirements. We got questions about that, but we'll go beyond that, including talk about vacation time, right? Your hard-earned vacation time. What legally can companies do to take that away from you at the end of the year? Is that okay? I know a lot of people do it. Do you have a case against them? Can you be fired for legally using cannabis now that it's legal here in Illinois? Can your employer still fire you if you use that? So we got a lot coming up with Jeffrey Colwin and plenty more. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association here on 720 WGN. Welcome back to Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. John Hansen here on this Labor Day Saturday afternoon. Thanks so much for spending part of your three-day weekend with us. All right, my next guest is, I always love talking to Dean Vic Amar of the University of Illinois from the law school. You always make me smarter, Dean.
That's a nice thing to say, John. Thank you.
You don't sound like you believe me, but trust me, you absolutely do. And you make our listeners smarter, too. You know, you cover so many different things, obviously, at the University of Illinois, and your background is illustrious as well in the Supreme Court, working as a clerk, too. So I would hope that you could break down a few things for us. And I know the big story of the week, legally speaking, was what the Supreme Court first didn't do and then did do overnight Wednesday into Thursday, refusing, I guess, to hear the case of the abortion law in Texas. I just am curious, what sort of, you know, I'm used to the normal cycle, right? Like the justices hear cases in October and in the fall, we get cases resolved in the spring and summer. What is this? What are these emergency meetings? What are these quote unquote shadow dockets?
So the normal docket for the Supreme Court, as you point out, runs from October to June. And it involves cases that have already been heard by the lower courts. So they may have been heard by a trial court and then a court of appeals, in some instances by a state Supreme Court. And the loser in the most recent court below will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to consider granting review in the case. They do that by what's called filing a petition for a writ of certiorari, which takes several months. And the court usually takes several months to consider whether to grant review. It takes four of the nine justices to go ahead and grant review. And if review is granted, then the parties file briefs on the merits about why the lower court was right or wrong. The court hears a full-fledged oral argument and then takes several months after that to issue full-fledged opinions. Now, in addition to that normal docket, there's always a set of emergency questions that come to the court during the October to June cycle, but also during the summer. And these are cases that are not fully briefed by the Supreme Court, where there's not full-fledged oral argument, where the court doesn't take a long time to decide whether to grant review, and it doesn't take a long time to decide the case. They're decided on a much more truncated basis. Now, the quintessential example of something like this might be a request for a stay, right, or a blockage of a capital execution. That's something that if the court's going to step in, it has to step in right away, because if it doesn't, the person will already be executed and there'll be no more case. But increasingly, there's a lot more of these emergency applications to the court for the court to step in before the lower courts have really heard the case and to act very quickly and without a lot of process. Some people call this or parts of it the so-called shadow docket, because there's not full-fledged oral argument, there's not full briefing, there's not amicus briefs by all kinds of advocacy groups, and it's decided on a much quicker timeline. And a lot of people don't think that the process for deciding those cases is nearly as robust and is not as likely to generate deliberate, careful decision-making by the court. So that's what we had.
Right. In this case,
this case fell into that category because the lower courts haven't really ruled on the merits of this case. And in fact, the lower courts decided not to rule on the merits right now, but to just let the Texas law go into effect and then hear challenges to this law later after it's applied against various abortion providers. And the abortion providers went to the Supreme Court and said, well, if the law gets put into effect That's really bad for us. So you have to block it from going into effect in the meantime. And the court said, well, we don't think this is one of those things where we need to step in and interrupt the normal course of appellate review.
That was well summarized. Thank you. We did get the decision as like a 5-4 with Justice Roberts joining the liberal justices. For these shadow docket rulings, do we always get the who's on which side for it? Or is it sometimes just a written statement? Or is it sometimes just silence is your answer?
Yeah, you often don't get. What you'll get is a decision by the court, which means a majority thereof, to deny the request for emergency review. And then the question then becomes whether any of the people that would have granted review want to be on record to that effect and also the reasons why they would want to grant review. So you'll often have the dissenters weigh in to explain why they think a majority of the court was wrong not to step in. But you won't really have the reasoning of the majority often to decide to explain why they didn't step in, although sometimes they will issue a short opinion explaining the decision to deny. Now, if they grant the unusual review, then they almost always the majority thereof will almost always explain why they're granting the review and what they're doing to try to preserve the status quo in the meanwhile. Now, remember, too, John, that Supreme Court does not, and this is really, really, really important. The Supreme Court typically does not decide cases to do justice to the parties. By that, I mean they're taking cases to issue statements of law that have broad ramifications, not to make sure that individual litigants are treated right. So the only reason ostensibly that they will step in the shadow docket cases is to preserve their opportunity to get at an issue that they think is of general importance and where time is of the essence, such that if they don't step in now, they're worried that something will happen that will prevent them from taking up the issue later in the normal course that we described earlier on the, you know, the full briefing and oral argument format. So the court's decision not to grant review doesn't mean that it agrees with what's going on. And it doesn't even mean that the issue is not ultimately worthy of Supreme Court attention. What it means is the court doesn't think that there's anything particularly time sensitive about having to take the case now, because they think that later on the issue will come back and they can look at it later if they want to, recognizing that in the meanwhile, some parties may be hurt by the delay. Court's not there to really worry about the parties. The court's there to worry about the law and the formation of the law in the long run.
Interesting. So I know they already have a case that they are going to hear in this next upcoming term in out of Mississippi. I think it's a 15-week abortion ban. I don't know all the particulars. So someone had mentioned, I saw on one of the programs, that they could actually, in theory, roll this case into that. Is that done by someone actually suing and working their way through it? Or can they, on their own decision, kind of lump this in, this Texas decision, into the Mississippi law?
Well, there has to be some kind of a request before them, before they can do anything with the case.
Okay.
So they can't reach out and pull cases in. The court is a passive, not an active actor in that regard. But once the parties have put something before the court, and here they have, at least before yesterday, the court can always decide to consolidate that pending matter with another pending matter and resolve them at the same time or by means of the same set of opinions, et cetera. So my guess is in this case, the parties, abortion providers, will probably come back to the court and ask them for some other kind of relief. And that'll be the hook that the court could possibly use to connect this case to the other case in which they've already granted review that poses important, albeit somewhat different, questions about the future of abortion protection under the Constitution.
Don't they know that we're in a 24-hour news cycle? We got Twitter now. We need answers quick.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because if there's one institution that is supposed to stand for everything that the 21st century unfortunately rejects, which is careful, deliberate, in-depth, balanced analysis, it's the Supreme Court.
Right.
And I think part of the problem is that there are so few institutions like that anywhere left. Everyone wants things quick and short. And the law is too complicated to resolve things really quickly and in a few words. And that's frustrating for people in this century, but it's really the problem of the mindset of the century, not the problem of the court.
Okay, fine. So you're telling me to get over it. I get it. No, I agree. Like, I do feel like in this rush of everyone wanting quick answers and to judge each other, right? I do appreciate that there is still an institution that takes its time. It is aggravating, especially for people who feel that this law is overreaching, or any law is overreaching and will harm them in the immediate. Of course, I'm not trying to make light of that, but that there is this deliberative body that does work through arguments slowly, I think should be reassuring to Americans, not a cause for blowing up the internet or canceling the Supreme Court.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I think the exhibit A for that, John, is what happened 20 years ago in the wake of the Bush-Gore presidential election. Now, there the court felt it had to act quickly because time was of the essence. But I think even people who supported George Bush and the legal position that he advanced, although I think it had some problems, I think everyone would realize or recognize that the opinions that the Supreme Court issued in the so-called Bush versus Gore case were much less careful and much less high quality than they might have been had the court had the normal time to think about and write its opinions. So something I tell my incoming law students every year, that in a world of Twitter where you have a limited number of characters, they have to approach the law very differently. The texts are the kind that you can't summarize in a few words, and you have to spend a lot of time wading through. And maybe I'm just an old stick in the mud, but that is reassuring to me, as you said.
You are not an old stick in the mud. I've got more questions for Dean Vic Amar of the University of Illinois Law School after this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Welcome back to Let's Get Legal here on 720 WGN. All this powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Thanks so much for spending some of your Saturday Labor Day weekend here with us, getting a little bit smarter with the University of Illinois Dean Vic Amar. We've got some more dumb questions for him. But first, I do want to let everyone know in the next hour, we've got a great guest, employment law attorney Jeffrey Colwin. He does more than that, but he knows a lot about employment law. We're going to talk about vaccine requirements. We've been talking a lot about that, but I really want a legal perspective on that and on masks as well as about things you post on social media. Can you really get fired for that sort of thing? Any questions you have too, 312-981-7200. You know that's the number. Maybe text a few of them in right now. I can prep and get some more questions ready for Jeffrey Colwin. That's in the next hour. And we've got a 3-hour show today. It's a little bit of a bonus hour at 5 o'clock to 6. Normally we wrap up at 5. But Dahlia Saper is going to be here in the 5 o'clock hour. She's a social media expert attorney, and I'm really fascinated by some topical things that have to do with social media. TikTok is collecting our biometric data, apparently. Other social media accounts do that right now, but they're based here in the U.S. And, of course, TikTok based in China. That has some interesting ramifications. And we'll also be talking with Dahlia Saper about the fact that even though certain politicians and people have been banned from Facebook or from Twitter, the Taliban hasn't. And that's oddly very odd. I'll just leave it at that. Dahlia Saper will pick up where we left off. I got a couple other questions, Dean Vic Amar, if you're okay with that.
Sure.
How much influence does the Chief Justice have aside from, well, you mentioned earlier about how if they're in the majority, they can assign the majority case. But we often talk about like the Roberts Court and that sort of thing. Is there any other influence a Supreme Court justice has besides assigning who gets to write the opinion?
You know, that's the primary power that chief justices have to shape opinions by making writing assignments. The chief also has an administrative role where he oversees the court. He oversees the facility, the building, the office space, the resources of all the justices, etc.
He's an office manager too. He does.
he has help, but he is. A lot of the chief's time is spent. You know, there are protests on the footsteps of the Supreme Court outside. He's got to deal with that. He's got to deal with funding of the judiciary and the Supreme Court. So he's the one who goes to Congress and testifies to explain why the court needs more money, or the federal judiciary needs more judges in the lower courts. He is the head of the entire federal judicial apparatus. But in practice, I think the Chief Justice's power to really shape the institution goes beyond these formal tasks that he performs, and it really relates to the historical tradition that attends the Chief Justice and the respect that people afford the Chief Justice because he is the first among equals. So I think John Roberts, for example, has a significant sway over some of the justices. For example, I think Brett Kavanaugh and Justice Amy Barrett are probably going to be influenced by the tone and the example that the chief sets. And I do think it is the Roberts Court, not just because he's the ideological fulcrum or center of the court, but also because he's just a very balanced, temperate, lawyerly person. That's part of why he was a good choice to make as a chief. You want, as a chief, someone who's not mercurial. I mean, you may love Antonin Scalia, but he doesn't have the temperament of a chief, whereas John Roberts does. And I think that chief-like temperament enables you to influence some of your colleagues in the way that, you know, as a dean or a chancellor of a university, I hope those of us in the administration can influence our colleagues.
Yeah. I know we've heard so many stories about Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, both passed, obviously, now being friends, despite being on way different sides of the ideological spectrum. Do the justices all get along?
Generally speaking, they do.
I hear something in your voice there.
Well, no, I think historically there have been some justices who might have some personal flashpoints with some other justices. But in the past 30 or 40 years, I think it's been a very collegial body. Even when you've had people like Clarence Thomas or Brett Kavanaugh come to the court after a very contentious confirmation process. Remember, right, Anita Hill for Clarence Thomas and Dr. Blasey Ford for Brett Kavanaugh. But once someone's on the court, I think the other justices realize, hey, this is a small group. We got to work with each other in close quarters for decades to come. Many decades to come in some instances. So they make a good effort to really separate the vehement disagreements they might have over law and case resolution on the one hand from the personal integrity and intelligence that each of them brings to the task. So I think they do get along okay. I don't know that there are that many of them that are super, super close friends with each other. Occasionally, right, that happens. As you mentioned, Scalia and Ginsburg. I think Chief Justice Rehnquist was friendly with Bill Brennan and others. And I know that, you know, Justices Marshall and Brennan were close to each other. So there are some close friendships, but I would liken it to a law faculty, a well-functioning law faculty. You have some groups of people who are really close personally, and if things are going right, everyone gets along pretty well, even if not everybody is buddy-buddy with everybody else.
I liken it to a close radio station, Vic.
There you go. That may be true, too.
Yeah, I have so many other questions, but Vic, I've already taken up too much of your time. Dean Amara, the University of Illinois Law School. I hope you'll do this again. We got a lot of more questions coming in we don't have time for, but I really appreciate your time.
Anytime you'd like, I'd be happy to continue the conversation. Thank you so much for having me, John.
Yeah, it's so fascinating getting a peek behind the rope, the curtain. I don't know what to say. Behind the Supreme Court. We'll just end it at that. Yeah, and it is. I just am so blown away that the Chief Justice, I think that was my craziest answer that I heard just then, was the idea that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, not only in all of his roles, it's only been men so far to hold that role, won't be for long, I imagine, but that his job also entails all the office work, running the actual office of what the Supreme Court is and the entire judiciary. Vic Amara was the gentleman you just heard there, worked for Justice Harry Blackmun of the United States Supreme Court for many years as well as a clerk. So it's a fascinating look at what happens at the Supreme Court. All right, 312-91-7200. I've got another crazy lawsuit for you. 312-981-7200. Can you fill in the blank here? Aridian, I like this one a lot. A used car salesman named Andrew Rector attended a New York Yankees game back in July of 2014. ESPN was broadcasting the game. They caught him on camera doing what? And because of that, he ended up suing ESPN. So 312-981-7200. What was this Yankees fan caught doing on camera that led to him suing ESPN for what happened on camera? Ooh, 312-981-7200. If you can guess that one, we would love to have you on the air for that. And as I mentioned a little bit while ago, next hour, the entire hour, we got Jeffrey Colwin in. I cannot wait to chat with him. It's Labor Day weekend, so we're going to talk about employment law. That's his area of expertise, about all sorts of things in relating to our jobs. What can or can we not be fired for? What recourse do we have if we think we've been wrongfully terminated? Do you have rights to privacy at work? Okay, yeah, maybe so. Which ones are they? Which ones are they not? And then again, in the 5 o'clock hour, Dahlia Saper talking about how the Taliban has Twitter, which is crazy, or at least some members of the Taliban. That's a little crazy to me. But 312-981-7200. Can you guess what the Yankees fan sued ESPN for? He was caught on camera doing what? Here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Had a lot of answers on the text line that I cannot read about the guy who was at the Yankees game and he was caught on camera doing something. No, your minds went to all the wrong places. Nothing criminal in public. Okay, I'll go with that. Let's hope that Lee has the answer. Lee's calling from Chicago Heights. Good Saturday afternoon, Lee.
Thank you.
How are you?
I think he was caught on camera with someone who wasn't his wife.
Oh, boy, that is a great... I wish that was the answer. But Lee, no, that is not the correct answer. But that's a way better story than what the actual one was. So let's just change it to that. That has happened, though, in other cases. I have seen on social media where someone is behind someone who is texting someone they shouldn't be texting, and they take a video of them doing that, and then they blast them on social media, which I guess that's what you got coming if you do that, Lee.
Right.
All right. No, it is not.
I'll be waiting to hear what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for the call, Lee. No, I appreciate it. 312-981-7200 if you got any last second guesses. But we are butting up on the news. Reading, do you have any guesses on what it might be? What the guy was caught doing on camera, and then the announcers made fun of the guy for about 30 seconds?
Was he picking his nose?
No, that's a great guess, too. No, he was not. And this was not a George Costanza moment. He was caught in the Seinfeld episode eating ice cream, making love to an ice cream sundae. No, he was caught sleeping. So the announcers poked fun at him for like 30 seconds because he was sleeping during the game. He sued the network for $10 million. The judge immediately threw it out, saying he was only on camera for 30 seconds. The jokes don't amount to defamation. All right. Time for the news on WGN. Every report that Bob Kessler does is stellar, but that one was great, Bob.
Really?
Yeah, that one was above and beyond.
Oh.
So thank you for
Glad
that.
Glad you liked it.
I did. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. After the break, we got Jeffrey Coolin. And hey, it is Labor Day weekend, so let's talk about employment. Let's talk about jobs, and we got an employment lawyer, an expert, to do just that with us for the entire hour. So we want your questions, 312-981-7200. We'll start the 4 o'clock hour in 2 minutes, but I do want to give you one more crazy lawsuit here, 312-981-7200. Can you tell us why two New York Giants fans sued police officers at the stadium for what they considered a violation of their First Amendment rights? What did they want to do that they were told they were not allowed to? 312-981-7200. Try and guess it, and we'll have Jeffrey Colwin weigh in on that as well after the break here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Jeffrey, how are you doing here today?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
Doing good. You enjoying the view here of our gorgeous studios?
It is beautiful up here for sure.
Even on a cloudy day, still looks really good. Okay, before the break, we teased another ridiculous lawsuit from two New York Giants fans. They sued the police officers at the stadium for what they considered a violation of their First Amendment rights. We have a Ron and a Don on the phone lines to try and guess which one is which. Let's start with Ron in Batavia. How you doing, Ron? Good afternoon.
I'm good. How are you doing?
Very good. What do these New York Giants fans want to do?
I believe they wanted to hang a banner from the stadium that said Trump won.
Ooh, I've been seeing cases of that, and I've been seeing people rip them down, but that is not this particular case. I guess I should have given you the year of 2017, so this is not very recent. But that's a great guess, Ron, because I know that's been going on. So thanks for the phone call. Let's go to Don. Don from Aurora. Don, what's your guess?
Hey, John, good afternoon. I'm going to guess cursing and slander.
Yes, they sued to curse and use the middle finger. They were kicked out of the game for using the excessive force, they said, which, of course, is well beyond their First Amendment rights. But they were a little angry that they weren't able to curse and use the middle finger. Sounds like New York Giants fans to me, Don.
Yeah, how about it? Welcome to the Big Apple.
Yeah, exactly. Don, thanks for the phone call, all right? We appreciate it.
All right.
Have a good one. Would you have gotten that one right, Jeffrey?
No.
Yeah, you can't curse. I know booing's been the topic of conversation this whole week after the Javi Baez stuff going on, but we'll move on from that. Jeffrey, let's talk a little bit about what you do. Employment law is really important. I know your briefcase is bigger than that, but this is something that obviously so many of us have a relationship with our employers that we need to know what our rights are in a lot of these situations, and I feel like a lot of people don't. Do you feel that way too?
I do feel that way. I did see a recent statistic that about 90% of the working force works for somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so these laws apply to an awful lot of workers.
Right. And I know that each state has different laws and that's difficult to navigate. And we'll try and do some of that. 312-981-7200. If you've got any questions for Jeffrey about employment law, do not slander any of your employers on the broadcast. You can be as general as speaking and, of course, never able to give 100%. You'll give your best advice, Jeffrey, or at least your thoughts on the matter from a professional perspective. But let's start with, I think, what everyone is wondering here. And I know it's something that we've talked about, but it's great having you here. We're wearing masks again, going back to work. We are vaccinated. A lot of folks are. A lot of folks aren't, though. And everyone wants to know, can employers fire you if you, A, aren't vaccinated and they want you to be, or B, you don't wear a mask in the office?
The short answer to the question, John, is yes, except in a couple of different circumstances. With respect to the vaccines, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, has stated that laws don't prohibit employers from requiring employees to be vaccinated. Similarly, recently, Governor Pritzker entered an executive order that required all individuals to wear masks in indoor spaces. The question is, when can you be exempted from those two requirements? Mm-hmm. And in both circumstances, it's really two ways. One is if you have a medical condition that prohibits you from wearing a mask or from getting a vaccine. Or the second is if you have a disability and you can't wear the mask.
For those, you'd probably need some sort of documentation, I imagine, right?
A document from a note and an employer to review it and see if that can be accommodated. There is one other small exception. Well, it's not small. It's a large exception. And that is that an employer cannot discriminate against an employee for religious reasons. Mm-hmm. So if you have a religious objection, sincerely held belief about not taking the vaccine, then that would be one third way to avoid having to take that.
I know there's been some interesting decisions and things that pastors have even said about whether they want to offer people religious exemptions. I know Cardinal Supich said that they should not just offer it broadly speaking based on the Catholic religion. And that's an interesting thing. It has to be a genuinely held belief, which is probably not easy to prove, is it, Jeff?
A sincerely held religious belief is generally interpreted broadly. You know, an employer can, if they have an objective, good faith basis, ask for some supporting information to justify that religious belief. But in either case, an employer can still require vaccines if it's the case that it could cause a danger to other employees. So then the burden would shift to an employer to show that the danger outweighed the accommodation.
Did things change when Pfizer became fully FDA approved? Was there still some wiggle room because it wasn't fully FDA approved? Or did that not really weigh into too many things? Maybe that was the cover that the employer wanted to have. Okay, now that this has been approved. Did that matter in terms of legality? Has things changed because of that?
What I think happened is that legality incentivized a lot of employers to require the vaccine. The EEOC came out and said that vaccines were okay before the vaccine was approved.
Okay. Have we seen any cases where this has already been challenged?
Well, the case that I think is most familiar is the one out of Texas. And I believe it was nurses who sued. And the Supreme Court did not take the case and allowed the vaccine mandate to stay in place. And that really set the stage for everything that happened after that.
Do you anticipate more lawsuits like this? I mean, I imagine they're going to come, whether it's the masks or the vaccines.
The more that people are coming back to work, the more you're going to see people challenging those requirements.
But for the most part, it seems like it's settled law.
Well, we live in an at-will state, which means that an employer generally sets the rules of the road, and you need an exception to avoid these requirements. The exceptions are few and far between, and I think that that's what's going to rule the day.
Jeffrey Colwin, by the way, if anyone's stepping out of their car and they want to reach you for more information, what's the best way to get a hold of you and what you guys do at the firm?
Sure. Well, you can find me on all social media sites, or you can call me directly at 312-374-5305.
In radio, we read the number twice, so go ahead, give it out one more time.
That is 312-374-5305.
You went into a good radio voice there, Jeffrey. Nice job. We appreciate that.
It's the environment.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so get your questions in, 312-981-7200. Jeffrey's not going anywhere. He's sticking around for the entire hour. Quick break here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. So happy to be joined with Jeffrey Colwin, attorney at Colwin, Mashapinto, and Colwin, dealing with employment law and all the different areas of that here on this Labor Day weekend. Why not focus on employment, right? Jeffrey, it works perfectly. It fits the theme. And you're okay with taking a couple questions, 312-981-7200. If you got yours, he'll do his best to answer them. Let's go to Adam. Adam, you're in Chicago. What's your question, sir?
Hi. So I work at a major company, and because of COVID, of course, we were forced to take pay cuts. Some persons got demoted. Some persons actually got laid off. And this is management people. So now what they're doing, we're back at pre-COVID numbers. They're calling everybody back into the office. And now they're posting those jobs. So I'm one that I was demoted, took a huge pay cut, but now they're posting my job, and I guess I have to re-interview. I mean, legally, can they do that?
Did they make a promise to you that you'd have it back or something?
No promise, nothing. Because because of COVID, it was very uncertain if the company was going to even survive.
Okay, yeah.
But we've done a good job of surviving, and now I'm like, okay. Like, I go to HR and I said, hey, if COVID never happened, I don't have any performance issues, no attendance issues, I would still be, my previous position. So how are you posting my job and I have to interview it along with persons you can actually pay, less money?
All right. Adam, that's a great question. Jeffrey, I know you would need more specifics, obviously, that we won't get to on air. But what's your general take on this question?
Well, John, generally speaking, we live in an at-will employment state, which means that an employer can fire or demote an employee for any reason at all, as long as it's not an illegal reason. So in this case, if the employer had a legitimate reason for the demotion,
like COVID is a legitimate reason, yeah,
likely so. And if the employer had legitimate reasons for posting the job or interviewing other people, it would be difficult to argue that they had an obligation to take an employee back.
What would be some of those illegal reasons that you mentioned there?
Sure. Well, it's illegal for an employer to take an employment action because somebody's race or sex or national origin. It would be illegal for an employer to take an adverse action because an employee exercised one of their legal rights, such as filing a claim for workers' compensation or reporting illegal discrimination or whistleblowing.
Mm. Adam, that doesn't sound like great news for you unless you feel like in one of those subsequent illegal areas it was for you. But I hope that helped answer your question, my friend.
No, it does. Just a little bit further. So if I could prove that it was one of those protected classes, then I would have a case, correct?
Adam?
Yes, if you could show that that was the employer's motivation for taking the action, then that would be something I would consider calling an employment lawyer about.
How hard is that? It's got to be somewhat hard to prove, right?
Proving intentional discrimination is a very difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Well, Adam, I think you need to write down this number, 312-374-5305. I'll mention it a few more times because I'm sorry that happened to you, my friend. Thanks for calling in, though. Okay, Adam?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, good luck. Yeah, I bet that that is, you know, I think a lot of people feel like, look, it's like one of the worst things to happen to you emotionally, professionally. You think you're moving along in your career. You don't understand the motivation of your boss. But just because you feel hurt, and I've been here too, doesn't mean you have a legal case as much as you may want. And not saying that Adam doesn't for one of those other reasons. Do you find that sometimes that people call you and they're just like, help me out, just because they're desperate? And why wouldn't they be?
I think one of the hardest things to explain to employees is that under the law, a termination that is unfair or unjustified is not always illegal.
Yeah, I hear that too. 312-981-7200 to get on the phone lines to ask Jeffrey any other questions. Please do so. We'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200. In fact, we're getting one right now from John. John is in Lincoln Square. And John, I think you're asking a little bit more about the vaccination thing. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, well, thank you. I wanted to ask, if I work in an office where masks are required, if you're not vaccinated, is it legal to, if someone walks into my office, to ask if they're vaccinated, if they have no mask on or not?
So like just a customer walks in or a client or something or
no,
someone?
No, someone, it would be an employee, another employee within the company.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I got this correct. So there's not a rule that you have to be vaccinated. There's just a rule that if you aren't, you must wear a mask. And in that case, you're asking, can other employees ask about your vaccination status at work?
If they are correct, if they do, say, walk into my office or someone's office without a mask on, are you legally able to ask them if they're vaccinated?
Ah, I see what you're asking. Ooh, that's an interesting one, Jeffrey.
It's kind of a tricky one there.
Yeah, it is a little tricky. What are your thoughts, Jeffrey?
Well, in our society, it's a very touchy subject to ask people about their medical conditions. Most people know and are familiar with the law HIPAA, which protects medical information only under certain circumstances. And I don't believe HIPAA would apply in that circumstance. So it probably would be okay as long as you don't violate an employer's policies. That being said, I would be very sensitive about asking somebody about their medical situation.
Yeah, and they aren't under the obligation to answer it unless it's HR. I don't really know, because that is an interesting angle. Like, obviously we're having these vaccine mandates for a lot of companies, but that's got to be a tricky world to navigate for the employer themselves, right?
I would think all those questions would be directed to HR rather than confronting somebody yourself as an employee.
Yeah. All right. Does that answer your question, John?
That does. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Absolutely. 312-981-7200. Two for two, Jeffrey, with satisfied callers answering their questions. Please get your calls in, 312-981-7200. Okay, here is an interesting one. In Illinois, it is legal to consume cannabis, right? Cool for people that want to do it, whatever if you don't want, but it is legal. It is the law in the state. Can an employee still have a policy saying you can't use it and then fire you for it?
That's a complicated question.
Ooh, I like it. A good complicated one.
Complicated.
Here we go.
Complicated question. Well, there's a couple of laws that apply to this issue. One is the Illinois Cannabis and Regulation Act, and the other one is the Right to Privacy and Workplace Act. And essentially, what those two laws say is that an employer cannot fire you for using cannabis off the clock, but you can be fired or punished if you are high at work or if you test positive under a reasonable policy.
Okay, well, what do you mean by reasonable policy? Because THC can stay in your bloodstream, right, for like 30 days. And this, and we get into this, too, about the driving well under the influence of marijuana. Interesting. You're nodding at me as if it's like, yes, it is ambiguous for a reason.
I think the biggest problem there, John, is that there is no accurate way to test whether or not somebody has used cannabis in a particular period of time. Those tests can say whether or not you have cannabis in your system, but they cannot say when or whether the person is impaired.
Interesting. I want to make sure I got this right. So a company in Illinois can no longer have a policy saying you can't use cannabis off the clock. Or are there certain exceptions for that?
I would think that a safety-sensitive position, somebody operating machinery, could probably fit under some requirements that would prohibit cannabis use. But generally speaking, under the law, companies cannot take adverse actions against employees for use during non-work hours. But they can take action based on having cannabis at work, or if they have regular drug testing policies and you test positive they can take action. I do think we're expecting a law to come from the legislature that might clear some of this up, hopefully soon.
Yeah, because I imagine there's listeners out there that know someone who's been impacted in their employment by this exact thing, right? It's been, what, 9 months and 4 days? No, the law went into effect at the beginning of 2020, so it's been a year and 9 months now. So we're starting to see these cases, I imagine, pop up. 312-374-5305 if you want to reach Jeffrey. I guess the cannabis law is sort of a microcosm of many things, Jeffrey. As the world changes and as laws change through our state legislature, you all have to learn, we have to navigate these waters together a little bit, because as laws change, so do employment laws, right?
Exactly. I think what you're seeing now is that a lot of employers are dropping the requirement of cannabis abstinence as a requirement for work. Recently, Amazon, which is the country's second largest employer, withdrew their requirement that workers not use cannabis. And very recently, the Cook County Public Defender's Office changed their requirements to stop prohibiting cannabis use from Cook County public defenders.
Boy, the cannabis laws are so interesting because it's still federally illegal. It's still labeled a class one narcotic, I believe. Unless it's changed recently, I haven't seen it, but I believe so. Boy, these are interesting waters to navigate. I'm glad we have someone like you to do it for us, Jeffrey.
I'm glad to be here, Jeff.
Yeah, 312-374-5305 is Jeffrey Colwin's number. Call him for information about employment law if you got any questions. You're going to stick around for the next half hour, Jeffrey. We're going to talk about non-compete rules here in Illinois. We're going to talk about privacy rights in the workplace. We're going to talk about social media and how you use that and how your employer can do that. So buckle up, Jeffrey. We still got a half hour to go, okay?
Sounds great.
He's ready to go, too. I am as well. 312-981-7200 is the number here at WGN. Let's get those questions in now, and we're up against the news here. Bob Kessler coming up here on WGN. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Now, normally this half hour is our final half hour, but today we get a bonus hour. We are on until 6 o'clock, and we're taking you right up to Texas Tech versus Houston, which you'll hear at 6 o'clock. So an extra hour of Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, and we're using it wisely here today. It's Labor Day weekend. Thanks for giving us part of your time to listen, and in honor of that, we've got an expert in employment law, Jeffrey Colwin, joining us from the firm Colwin, Mashapinto & Colwin. And Jeffrey, here we go. 312-981-7200 for your questions. I know I'm about to enter a very wide scope of our relationship with our employers, and that's our right to privacy, which is, I imagine, hard to navigate, right? Because your employers have to know certain things about you. They want to monitor certain things that you do maybe outside of the office. So this is a pretty wide range. What privacy rights do us as employees have? Or does it really matter or depend on what your job is?
Well, everything matters based on what your job is.
Right.
But generally speaking, employees have very limited privacy rights when they're using their employer's equipment. Computers, your employer's smartphone. Most of those devices can be monitored all the time, except for a few small instances relating to private calls.
So if you were sending emails that you shouldn't have been sending and the boss says, hey, we saw these emails, you have no recourse, essentially, most likely.
Most likely, if you're using your employer's equipment, it's not private.
That's a really good baseline, right? Like if you are at the office, things that happen in the office, of course, the employers, have a purview over and the equipment they're using. Does it get a little bit more blurry on what you're doing on your private time on your own private phones and computers? I mean, they still have got to be somewhat interested in what you're doing and have some rights to know some of that, but What are the boundary lines there? If you're on your own time, you get to do whatever the heck you want?
Well, it's interesting. I read a recent survey that said about 87% of companies were relying on employees to use their personal smartphones for business. If all those employees are using their personal smartphones for business, then they are mixing confidential information, employer information, with their personal information. And that's where I think it gets tricky.
Yeah, well, right, because I've used my own phone for sending emails all the time. Should we not be doing that? Or is that up to the employers to provide us with the equipment to not do that?
It used to be the case that that was a perk, a benefit that you would get would be access to a device. Nowadays, employers are asking them or requiring employees to use their own device. the recommendation that most people don't like to hear from me is don't mix your personal stuff with your work stuff. But I think maybe a more helpful piece of information would be this. Most employers who require these types of things have a bring your own device policy, a BYOD policy.
Okay.
And if I were working for an employer that had such a requirement, I would look for that policy and figure out how do they determine which data is protected and which data is private.
Do they have to lay it out? I mean, and say, hey, it's if anything you do on Facebook, that is a private thing. Anything you do on Snapchat is private. Any email that is not associated with our email or doesn't have, you know, our name at the end of it, at blank.com, is your own thing. Is that basically how those are usually lined up?
I think the best employers would have a policy that would make that perfectly clear, so there was no gray area. But there is not a requirement for an employer to have that policy. Generally, social media is a whole different kettle of fish.
Yes.
What you say and what you do on social media can be the basis of a discharge if the employer doesn't like the content of what you say. Except if you're talking about work issues, criticizing an employer for the purpose of communicating to other employees those circumstances.
Wait, we're going to slow down here. If I am the employer can terminate me or suspend me or whatever if I'm just posting something mean about the world, politically, getting too in deep, threatening someone else on Facebook. But you actually have protections if it's about the employer and what you're doing with other employees? Did I hear that completely wrong?
No, you heard it absolutely correct. The NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, has protected what's called protected concerted activity. And that applies whether you're in a union or not in a union. And essentially, the question is, are you discussing work issues and criticizing employers about working conditions, or are you just complaining about your job without attempting to engage other employees?
Okay.
If it's the former, it's protected. If it's just complaining, it is typically not.
What about if it's not, you're just posting, it has nothing to do with work, right? Like you have a really far fringed opinion about something, or you criticize an official not at work. Does that then come down to like what line of work you're in? And that is where you can run into trouble or not?
Always depends on what line of work you're in, John. But I would say it like this. Government, state employees have a First Amendment right to say basically anything they want on social media to a certain degree. Private employees who work for private employers do not. So what that means is if an employer doesn't like your politics or your social posting, they can, in many circumstances, take action based on what you say privately.
Well, what about police and fire departments? Those would fall under state or government employees?
Those are government employees for the most part, and they have additional protections that private employees don't.
That's interesting because we have seen cases where police officers and firefighters might say something about their jobs or not about their jobs, and people, you know, we trust the police or are meant to trust the police in certain things, but that they are afforded protection to be able to say what they want and be protected from termination.
The question really rises in that circumstance. Is the individual speaking as a private citizen? Or are they speaking in their capacity as a government employee? If they're speaking as a private citizen on a matter of public concern, generally speaking, that's protected. If they're speaking in their official capacity or as a part of their job, even if they're a government employee, then that would not be protected.
Can employees videotape us at work and monitor our productivity no matter where we are? That was a question from the 630.
Yes. Well, generally speaking, they can in certain circumstances. They can monitor areas for safety. They can monitor areas for productivity. What they can't do is monitor to you with video in private spaces, like locker rooms or sometimes break rooms. And generally speaking, the videotaping is limited to just visual, not audio recording. That would be prohibited by eavesdropping laws.
Oh, really? So they couldn't, like, if I'm talking about my boss at my desk quietly to my friend, as long as they didn't overhear it, like, just by passing by, they cannot record that and say, look at what you said about the boss.
Generally speaking, here in Illinois, it's a two-party consent state, so if they cannot record you illegally. Now, if the employer says, I'm going to be recording everybody, and by working here, you are consenting to being recorded, then all bets are off.
Right. And that's important. And that does that go for that goes for videotaping too, I imagine, right?
Generally speaking, most employers will notify their employees in advance that all this is happening to establish consent.
It's interesting that all these, I mean, obviously workplaces have to have these rules and regulations and it has to be spelled out. But I imagine employers have to battle this idea of, okay, that's our policy. But in this day of social media where we can find out what a company is doing and the general public finds that to be overreaching, employers have to kind of navigate those waters too. The onus is on them to not only, especially if they're selling a product that we all want, you don't want to hear that company XYZ is monitoring their every word that their employees are saying. So for employers, that's they have to navigate that too.
Yes, employers are limited by the laws and by social circumstances in which those laws exist.
312-981-7200 is our number if you have any employment questions for Jeffrey Colwin. If you want to reach him, 312-374-5305. We'll continue our conversation after this on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Do you grill, Jeffrey? Or are you a big cook or no?
We grill a little bit, but I will say we use a meat thermometer all the time.
All the time. I was using it. I was making fish the other day, and I don't know what I'm doing with salmon. Put it in the meat thermometer. They say 145. Boom, bang, I'm there, and it tasted great. I used it on a baked potato the other day, 205 to 212. You never know how your baked potato's done. Stick one of those things in there. This is not a segment about meat thermometers, though. We're talking about employment law with Jeffrey Colwin. 312-374-5305 is his number. Our number is 312-981-7200. You probably know that. Let's get some last-minute questions in here. Let's talk about your personnel file. First of all, Jeffrey, what is a personnel file? And do I get to see, as the employee, what is in that?
A personnel file is a collection of documents that an employer keeps recording your background and sometimes your employment history, things like reviews or write-ups or discipline. It is up to an employer to decide what information to keep in that file. But the important thing to know is that we have a law here in Illinois that allows employees the right to request to review their personnel file twice per year during employment and up to 1 year after they've left employment.
So what is the advantage of doing that? So I might just say, well, what's in there? I probably know what's in there. I get my review every couple of months or every year. I know what it's going to say.
Well, you work for a good employer. I think
I do. Thanks, WGN.
I think it's important to check and see what's in your personnel file because sometimes there are errors. Sometimes there are corrections. And in litigating these types of cases for over 20 years, on occasion, I have found employers who put different information in a personnel file than they've given to the employee.
Can that be used to bolster a case of employment discrimination or something like that?
I would definitely try to do so.
Do you get to look at it? Can you make copies and keep it at home?
Under the law, you can make a copy. Your employer is allowed to charge you for the copy. But yes, you can take a copy of your personnel file
at home. The 5 cents, you mean? Like the nickel of the piece of paper? Or can they give you a fee or something like that?
Well, they can't charge you for the service, but they can charge you for the copy. So okay. Is that what a copy costs these days?
I don't
5 cents?
What do the copy cost these days? Just send me a PDF. That's what I want.
Those are free.
All right. So then, Jeffrey, my question is, even if you're a model employee or you feel really like you have a great relationship with your employer, I guess wouldn't it be good practice to get it every twice a year and just put it in a folder somewhere?
I think it's good practice to, on occasion, take a look at what's in your personnel file and make sure you have a copy of it, because you never know when you might need it in the future.
Absolutely. And for anyone that's been let go within the last year or they left their job, they can still get it then. We had a question from the 847. We're going to backtrack a little bit about recording people. And this person wants to know, can an employee record coworkers who they think are violating company policy and company safety rules?
The answer is generally no.
Right.
Here in Illinois, you need two-party consent to record. That means that everybody who is on the recording knows about it and is consenting to it. And if you make a recording like that and you don't have full consent, it's a crime.
Yeah. And the A4, it's a great question, though, because I think a lot of people that maybe are like, I can't believe this person's doing that. First of all, they should probably just go to HR and tell them, right, directly.
Generally speaking, yes. There is one important exception, though, to that law. And that is if you think the recording is going to produce evidence of a crime.
Okay.
If you think that by recording somebody, you have a reasonable belief that you will obtain evidence of a crime, that recording is exempted from the statute. It's a narrow exemption, and you need to be careful, but it is an exemption.
Interesting. We also had a question about recording. Can an employee record a disciplinary meeting? So let's say they're called in, they did something wrong, the employer's there, they want that for their records. Is it the same thing that the employer has to say yes and agree to it?
I think that would be the wise move, would be to get consent from the party you're meeting with and ask to make a recording. In my experience, I don't know many employers who would permit that type of activity, but if you ask and they allow you, then I would recommend it.
Heck yeah. I would want that recording no matter what. I'm someone who takes like frivolous notes during meetings because I forget everything that ever happened. But my handwriting, Jeffrey, is so bad. I'll even show you. This says John on it, and it just looks like chicken scratch. I can prove it to you. Yeah, I would love to. But yeah, you got to get your consent. So you can't just hit record and put it in your suit pocket. That would, again, violate that rule.
Not in Illinois.
Okay, good to know. Let's see. I had another non-compete rules. Right. A lot of people and we've heard about this. Not only when you hear non-compete, we think of someone maybe in my line of work. Right. You work for media. We have those in many of our contracts. But we've heard from cases from like fast food employees who have been told they have non-compete rules. Are those legal here in Illinois?
They are legal under certain circumstances. I think it was back in 2016, Illinois passed a law that prohibited non-competes for folks who were making $13 an hour or less. Just recently, Governor Pritzker signed an amendment to the Illinois Freedom to Work Act, which greatly expanded the prohibitions against non-competes and non-solicitation agreements. Starting in January of 2022, it's unlawful for a non-compete agreement to exist for employees earning less than $75,000 per year.
So if you make under $75,000, they cannot tell you, if you leave here, you have to wait 6 months before you go to a similar place.
Generally speaking, that would be prohibited, correct?
And I've often heard this kind of off the cuff, even for employees that make more than that. I mean, the company would still have to go through litigation to sue you for that, right? And they don't always win.
That's true. For a non-compete or a non-solicitation agreement to be enforceable, the business usually has to have a legitimate reason for protecting that type of work. And if they can't justify why the non-compete is legitimate, then it would not be enforceable.
And the onus is on them to prove that.
Well, they would be the ones suing in that instance, and yes.
Okay, that was an example of a dumb question already, and write that down, mark that there. 312-981-7200. Last question here for you. It's a three-day weekend, so let's talk. By the way, Chicago has a very rich history about why Labor Day is the way it is. We're going to talk a little bit about it as I fill it on Chicago's Afternoon News on Monday. Vacation time. So many employees have policies about if you don't use them by this day, they're gone forever. Are those legal policies to have? What is the vacation time rules as you see them here in the state of Illinois?
Well, Illinois does not per se prohibit a use it or lose it vacation policy.
Okay.
As long as the employee has notice that if they don't use it, they're going to lose it. And as long as the employee has a reasonable opportunity to take that vacation, then the policy can be enforceable. What an employer in Illinois cannot do is change the vacation policy after you've already earn time that you're expecting to take with you.
So if you have it in the bank, let's say, they can't say, okay, we've changed our policy, now you have to use it by the end of the year and you only have a month left to use it. No, you are entitled to use that time.
Generally speaking, that's correct.
And if you're let go, is vacation time something they have to pay you for if you've accrued it over time?
If there's not a use it or lose it policy, then yes, they would have to give you that vacation time as a part of your separating wages.
And then you can get your personnel file. There's a lot of rules for you. Jeffrey Colwin, we're out of time. That number again, 312-374-5305. I think you helped a lot of folks out. Hopefully come back again. Okay, Jeffrey?
Well, thanks, John. Thanks for having me here. And thanks for making the law so much more accessible to everybody. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. That's what we try and do here. Let's get legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Thank you very much, Kevin. Hey, it's 5:07 and you're still hearing Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Yes, we are on for an extra hour here today, and we're ready with a packed hour of great stuff. Dahlia Saper is going to join us. She is a social media expert. TikTok is doing something you may not like. Other social media companies do it too, but TikTok's based in China, and that's causing some issues. Also, the Taliban is on social media, yet some of our own politicians are not. Why is that? Is that okay? She'll break it all down. And then in the last half hour, if you love movies, if you love law, or you just love getting on the radio and having fun, we're going to play Name That Law Movie. I'll play you a clip and you got to name the movie. All coming up here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Welcome back to Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I hope you're enjoying your long Labor Day weekend. We're just at the start of it, and I'm so happy to be joined by the wonderful Dahlia Saper, who handles so many different things, but is kind of an expert. Not kind of. You are an expert, Dahlia, on all things social media. Thanks for sharing some of your weekend with us.
Thanks for having me back.
All right. So there's a couple stories I wanted to get to. And a couple weeks ago, this one came across my radar that a bipartisan group of senators, John Thune and Amy Klobuchar, wanted to talk to TikTok about a policy change that they had made. And I'm someone who uses TikTok a little bit here and there. And I didn't even realize there was a policy change that had to do with potentially collecting facial data or some components of what we use. I mean, what is it that TikTok is trying to get from us?
Well, I don't know what they do, but we know these tech giants are increasingly trying to make themselves smarter, especially as they're trying to use your data and link it with other people's data, primarily to make the platform more usable and to serve you up with advertisements that are more
More Wait, relevant. It's all about the money? They don't have these apps ready for us just
all
for our own enjoyment?
All about the money, yes. But I think TikTok is following in Facebook's footsteps. I mean, Facebook has repeatedly sued, especially in Illinois, where we have this biometric law that says you have to be full disclosure before you, scan someone's eyeballs. And TikTok is essentially mirroring or probably trying to replicate what other platforms before it have done when it comes to biometric information. The scare, of course, is that TikTok is the most downloaded app, I think, right now. And a huge portion of that is teenagers, including my teeny bopper. And the fact that its parent company is Chinese-owned raises concerns from our government and our politicians that this is just a really scary tool used by a foreign entity to collect information and control communication with our citizens.
It certainly sounds scary the way you put it, and you're obviously quoting concerns of other people. Just backing up one second, the biometric data stuff. So these are, in Illinois, we, like you said, have a rule saying that we have to be aware of it. What sort of biometric data is being collected? And do you think that some people just don't know it and they just click yes to any terms of policy change without ever digging into it?
I think most people do, right? If you want to use the utility that now is Facebook or TikTok, you have to kind of take it or leave it. It's not like I'll do this, but not that. Now, is it all nefarious? I don't know. I'm in the camp that sometimes giving up a little privacy is okay if it makes your life easier. So maybe I'm not in the camp where it's like, oh no, my privacy is being taken away. But it's nice when Facebook knows to tag people in my picture that I didn't have to go and to identify. That's a use. And so I'm sure whatever functionality that adds to the statute's point, hey, if I'm a user, at least I'm informed before I'm on this platform. And if I'm super scared that my eyeballs are being scanned, well, then maybe I don't go on TikTok. Maybe I have to deactivate my Facebook account. It's still a choice. There's no law that says you're entitled to a TikTok account or a Facebook account.
Really? There's not? Because for what I can tell, most people are. I wonder if Facebook knows that my hair is slowly graying in certain spots, and that's why I'm getting advertisements for Just for Men and other hair coloring options.
It does. Absolutely, it does.
Well, that's okay then. At least they're targeting me towards me.
That's right. So you're getting that instead of maybe something totally irrelevant that you're not interested in. And look, with enough backlash, certainly from the user base, these platforms do change policies. If it's from the U.S. government, I'm not sure, they can impose policies, but it's this real push and pull, tug of war between the users, the platforms, and the government.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and I wanted to ask if you ever watch congressional hearings that take place. Well, that's the most boring question I've ever asked in my life.
I'd like to sit down with some popcorn and watch, yeah.
Okay, so C-SPAN is on the house a lot in my home. And but that's just me. But I am always a little, ooh, when I watch, and this is through no fault of their own, our representatives, for the most part, generally speaking, are older than the average American. They are maybe less technologically advanced than the average American. Nothing wrong with that. But they're the ones that are making policies on this stuff. And sometimes when I watch these hearings, I have to shake my head at some of the terminology that they use to try and navigate this world. But they're kind of the last line of defense for some of this stuff, right?
Yeah, well, and that's kind of always been the case, right? We've got an increasingly savvy congressional body. They have to be, because to get reelected, they need people on their team that understand this stuff. So there is a shift there. But, you know, we're still figuring things out. Snapchat was the big thing, what, like 3 years ago. Now it's been set aside for the TikTok. And we'll blink and tomorrow there'll be a new platform. We are not as strict as our European counterparts, for example, that have started to implement a whole bunch of laws around privacy. The whole world is kind of shifting. The expectation of what is okay to collect and isn't okay to collect is shifting. All we can do as users is to be active and vigilant with our own information and make decisions in real time and not just kind of accept those terms of use blindly.
It's interesting you mentioned that Europe is a little bit stricter in that stuff, because I think there is maybe that we are just feel resigned to the fact that, well, that's what the app does and that's what we have to deal with. And if that's okay, then fine. But I guess there is something to be said that if you did really feel strongly against some of this data that is being collected or how these companies operate, enough political support could force some of these companies to lay off that a little bit. Is there just not enough momentum for a cause in this that we are just too resigned for it? Or maybe it's what we're talking about, that our congressmen, congresswomen aren't as savvy as we think they are? Because there could be a will to change some of this.
Well, right. And I think, as you know, we see this with Facebook. They're being both sides of the political spectrum are not happy.
Right.
You know, the Republicans are saying you're too onerous and too much of a censorship machine. And the left is saying you're not doing enough in light of the power you hold and the number of users you have. Now, we also have a reaction to sites like that. Like Parler was the big thing 5 minutes ago when, because of Twitter's decision to terminate, let's say, certain politicians and certain accounts.
I think we all know who you're talking about. Yep.
Right. Well, we have a free market. When we get to a point where they're so big that it's almost like we have no power, then we get these antitrust laws to come in, and you've got the FTC coming in. I don't have a happy answer or an easy right. way to answer that, other than to say is with enough pressure and with enough outrage and enough security risk, I think you will see changes and at a minimum some sort of legislation to further regulate the scope of Facebook, whatever, choose your platforms.
Right.
Obligations, responsibilities, and rights. Right now, they've got the Communications Decency Act on their side.
Right.
And until that legislation is changed, the law really says they kind of can do nothing or do what they want.
All right. And one thing that they're doing is upsetting a lot of folks right now, in part because you talk about people getting banned or not. The Taliban is all over our social media companies. We'll get to that after this on 720 WGN. Back here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association, Dahlia Saper joining me now. And I know this is a very fluid situation and it is ever changing. So, you know, 1 minute we could all be experts on certain things regarding Afghanistan and the Taliban, and then it changes a few minutes later. So having said that, it's very interesting. And there was a great article written about the fact that the Taliban and some of their leaders are using American social media platforms. And Dahlia Saper, I just don't know. I think a lot of people are like, well, why are certain people banned? I got in Twitter jail for a day once for posting a video I accidentally shouldn't have posted. Yet the Taliban is on there and using it. What do you think about that?
Well, Facebook has a tough job, right? They are trying to both moderate content, but not moderate content. Because on one hand, they're not supposed to be the publishers of anything that's on their platforms. And on the other hand, their own terms of use say, if you're using this platform for something offensive or that constitutes hate speech, we have the right to boot you off. So there's this kind of difficulty that Facebook faces, because on the one hand, they don't want their platform to be a resource for terrorists. And on right. the other hand, who's to say that a statement made by, you know, Joe Schmo is a terrorist statement versus just a really abhorrent opinion.
Right. How quick are they to react to these things? Because obviously if you're a big public figure, you know, people are going to report you if you say something that people think violated the terms of service. But I've heard that, you know, different, and whether it's the Taliban or other folks kind of jumping around, like especially on Twitter, like, oh, you got banned, I'm going to jump on this new one. Have you found that they're usually pretty resilient in shutting down accounts and keeping them shut down? Or does it sometimes, is there a lag time where new accounts get created by the same people?
Well, look, it's they have two-part system. They've got actual humans whose job it is to look at terrible things and make that judgment call. And then they're also implementing various artificial intelligence technologies using semantic intelligence to remove content automatically. So it's a two-part process. Facebook recently published its transparency report. It's fb.com. And they're trying to be really open about their processes and how they're implementing their various policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one whole section's on violence and incitement and what their standards are and what they're going to do if they think you've violated those.
Right. Yeah, it's all pretty much laid out. It's just, it is fascinating to think that someone that you may know or I may know gets banned for making fun of someone or something, and then there's the Taliban all over it. But it just brings up an interesting discussion that is way smarter than myself. Not you, Dahlia. You could handle it. But the idea that the Taliban has gone from trying to shut out internet access into Afghanistan into embracing it. And I guess that we've seen this related to other big movements in the Middle East, the Arab world, about there is a lot of power that is in social media. And I guess it shouldn't be any surprise that whether that's the Taliban or the American government, there's such power in utilizing social media and trying to gather people through whatever cause you're going for.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a big proponent of this free exchange of information. Like, if everything was like Wikipedia, as soon as the Taliban was in there, hopefully there's a way to go into those same forums. If it's the Taliban page, no, they wouldn't be so obvious.
Right.
Likely. But that's where you could go in and put in your own information to counteract the information that's being disseminated there. That's a really tough task when everything is so siloed.
Right.
But, you know, moderation and removal is absolutely wonderful, but it's not going to shut down all of that misinformation. The best, in my opinion, the best way to counteract misinformation is to put out more information.
Yeah, I agree with you in principle. I just feel like sometimes certain platforms are so big that it's hard to bring them down, that misinformation can spread so fast that when you counter it with the truth, that it's already done, right? Isn't the damage already done a bit?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a tough world to navigate. All right, Dahlia Saper, we have not solved all the world's problems in one interview, but we've gotten closer. Thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you.
She's great. Dahlia Saper, you can find out more information about all that they do at saperlaw.com. That's saperlaw.com. They do intellectual property, entertainment, social media, as we've been talking about, and business. And Aridian, I just find the world of social media law so fascinating. If nothing else, because it's always changing, right? Like the new app comes along, and it was an interesting discussion about how the people that write our laws and handle our laws are usually not the ones on TikTok.
Right? I didn't know that you were so active on TikTok.
I'm not really. I did one good video, and that's where I retired. Kevin Wells, are you a TikToker or what?
I am not. I usually get the good ones off of Twitter, or a friend of mine will send me in a text or something. But no,
Kev,
I do not have
it. That's what my dad does.
Don't make fun of him.
You call me, I'm not that old.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the things about these apps is that you see one on, they you cross-promote so much, right? Like if there's a TikTok video you want to see, all right, it'll end up on Twitter eventually. It'll end up on Facebook eventually.
And Facebook, yeah.
Yeah, I'll see it eventually. But it is interesting with the company being owned in another part of the world. But yeah, I watch a lot of C-SPAN, and it is interesting to watch people in their 70s and 80s, God bless them, the leaders of our country, who are trying to navigate this world of social media. It can make for some really interesting conversation. I remember I forget which congressman said it, but called the internet a series of tubes, and he has not let that down since that happened about 10 or 15 years ago or so. Hey, everyone, 312-981-7200. I've got one more crazy lawsuit, or I'm going to give you some of the facts, but you have to fill in the blank, and you can call in to win. 312-981-7200. We'll take the calls through the news. I'll prompt it here before we get to Kevin in about a minute or so. A guy got divorced from his wife, and he had to move back in with his parents. Boy, that's been sort of the theme here for this show, Ridian. People overstaying their welcomes with mom and dad. We told the story in the first hour about the mom and dad that sued their kid, who was 30 years old, and won, kicking him out of the basement after they had tried to get him out. Well, this man has sued his parents. Why? Because he says that they destroyed his what? He had personal property. He had moved back in with his parents. His parents destroyed his what? And he sued for it. 312-981-7200. What was he so bummed about? He had collected this for a long time. They destroyed it as soon as he moved in. He sued them, for $30,000. 312-981-7200 if you can guess the answer to that. And also after the news, we're going to play Name That Movie, and we'll give you a clip from a famous law movie, and you'll have to tell us what it is. Here on Let's Get Legal, time for the news on WGN. All right, 720 WGN, wrapping up the show, taking you right up to college football here. By the way, we had a great text from the 847 wondering, John, why didn't they win any prizes? Well, first of all, I would say the prize of getting to be on the radio and talk to us is all that it's worth.
Yeah, it's worth $1 million.
Worth $1 million. Don't try and sell it for $1 million. Don't try and sue us for $1 million. But no, the real reason, and Iridian knows this, is last week we were like, oh yeah, we should give away a prize. But I can't just like, I don't have it on authority of me just to start going through John Williams's office and start giving away his books or t-shirts or coffee mugs. He does that through Speed Jokes. But we've talked to Manchin. They are going to give us prizes. I just forgot to ask. So if anyone out there is like, oh, WG, no, it's me, John Hansen. I forgot, the host of the show, forgot to ask for permission for prizes. But I will defend any of them in court. I have not passed the bar, nor do I intend to at any point. So we'll have to wait and see. Okay, that'll do it for us today. Iridian, what's the one thing that you learned here today on Let's Get Legal?
There was so many things, you know?
Yeah.
But I learned that the Taliban were on social media. I had no idea.
Right. And it's not like at Taliban. It's different leaders, like the spokesperson.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just a fascinating world we live in, that they've got to wait until they violate certain terms of service. Mm-hmm. I mean, you might just look at it on its face and say, get them out of there.
Exactly.
But until they do the thing that they that the rules say you can't do. Mm-hmm. I know it's a weird world we live in, but that is that's the law. I learned a lot of things, including just different. When I research these lawsuits, that are the crazy ones, right? First of all, there's way more of them that people actually win than I realized. Yeah. But anyone, there was a couple we didn't get to mention today. There's someone who sued a beer company because, and it's called Kona Brewery. I don't know if you know them, but they, all their covers of, or all the art on their beer bottles has like big waves. It looks like Hawaii. It's like Hawaiian themed. But someone sued the company because they actually make all the beer in Tennessee and New Hampshire. But they were ruled, hey, they don't say made in Hawaii. Just because it depicts something that looks like Hawaii doesn't mean it's necessarily there. Someone sued jelly bean companies because they didn't realize that jelly beans had sugar in them.
Oh.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
that's not the smartest one.
Right. No, that's not. No, right? And judge said, no, you shouldn't assume. And then there are so many lawsuits already about people upset from bags of chips, boxes of Junior Mints, that the product does not fill the bag or the box completely.
Oh, yeah.
And the people sue. They're like, well, it's a third empty. How is that okay? And case after case, judge says, we all know that they're not filled to the top. It doesn't mean just because you're not happy that you can sue them. So that's what I learned, Iridian. Anyways, nice job today. We appreciate it. We will not be here next weekend. We've got a lot of great programming, including Northwestern football, that'll move things around. But thank you so much for listening to Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association.